All right, thanks for joining me, everyone. Charles Moskowitz, welcome to the program. Monday through Friday, I tend to do this live and also archived on all of the various sites that are carrying the program. My guest is John Stadden. He is an author. He's the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Professor of Biology Emeritus at Duke University. He is the author of the new book, Science in an Age of Unreason. He states, science is in trouble, real questions in desperate need of answers, especially those surrounding ethnicity, gender, climate change, and almost anything related to, quote, health and safety, are swiftly buckling to the fiery societal demands of what ought to be rather than what is. John, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Happy to be here.
You know, the intersection of science and politics became obvious to me when one time, and I'm not a scientist by any means, I wrote a short blog basically saying that the theory of evolution is not proven science, but it's theory by nature. And I got such angry response from people, both liberal and conservative. How could I say this? Oh my, that it made me realize that science is very political. It's not just what I had assumed it was previously, which was simply an objective search for truths and an observation of the natural world and how we are where we are in it, and all of the rest based on empirical evidence. So you have written a book on this very topic, the politicization of science. So let's get right down to what is the premise of your book here.
Well, the premise is actually a very old one. It comes from David Hume, the wonderful Scottish Enlightenment philosopher. And he made a distinction between facts and values, what is and what ought to be. And science is strictly about what is. Mm-hmm. The ought to be comes from a moral system, which may be religious or it may not be. It doesn't really matter where it comes from, but it's the values are a matter of faith. They're not provable by science. No, you can try improving your values, but you say, I do A because of B, I do B because of C. But then C rests on nothing but faith, which is fine. I mean, that's just the way it is. But I think a lot of people have difficulty in accepting that.
And I think that from what I gather, the theory, as you note, started by Scottish philosopher David Hume, is that science and faith are two separate categories. It's like the difference between apples and oranges. What the existence of one does not necessitate the extinction of the other. It's just two different studies of two different disciplines that exist as entities in and of themselves. It's not, you know, this whole idea that somehow, you know, they're in competition or that you can't have one without the other is false.
Absolutely. I mean, the metaphor I've used is that science is like a map. It's not a destination. In order to have a destination, you've got to have some kind of value system that you want to get here rather than there. I think that just about says it. And one of the problems, and I start the book with that, is that secular humanists, mm-hmm. often their values are so automatic to them that they don't realize that they are just as unprovable scientifically as the values of religious people. And I started this all out with a blog at, I think, Quillette, and I got a very hostile response from an evolutionary biologist who seemed to think that he could derive his values from science. And of course, he can't. Now, in a way, evolution is the best possibility. You might say, well, survival is obviously a good thing. Everybody would agree to that. So we can look at those things which favor the species and do those. And there are problems with that. I give some examples. For mm-hmm. example, if I don't want to run on, but if you were to make a decision about who should get COVID vaccines, for example, the humanitarian Christian and a lot of secular people would say, well, it should go to the most vulnerable people, those with comorbidities and old people. If you're a social Darwinist, you should say, no, they should be the last ones to get it because they are the least fit and contribute least to future generations. So unless you want to, I mean, it's very dangerous, is what I'm saying, to use evolution as a criterion, A, because it conflicts with a lot of things that almost everybody believes, and second of all, because you simply can't predict. I mean, you can't predict to take a current crisis. You can't predict whether a society where abortion is very difficult to get with the fitness of a society where abortion is easy to get. We simply don't know. It has to be a matter of...
You know, you bring up, of course, a basic paradox, which is that you have to, in order to conduct science, which is an objective look at nature, you have to include values which are subjective. Religious people believe that they're immutable and they come from a creator of the universe, something that I believe. But putting that aside, we obviously, by simple observation, must have a moral standard and ethical standard when we look at science. For example, we don't, you know, nuclear science. Should everybody have a nuclear bomb in their backyard? I mean, you know, the development of nuclear science is a great thing, but it involves a certain ethical standard, a certain civic standard. You know, it involves the involvement of society in terms of how to regulate that particular science. I mean, a more recent example is that we found out that certain doctors in the United States, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, were involved with financing gain-of-function research in communist China behind the back of two American presidents. You know, this is gain-of-function science? Yes, it is. You could probably isolate a virus out of an animal and transfer it to a human being if it's in a certain state. But is it ethical? Is it moral? It's apparently, President Obama didn't think so, which is why he banned it in the United States. It's dangerous and it has serious ethical questions. So I only mention this because we have to have an atmosphere of ethics based with all of the regulations that go along with that when we do scientific research. I mean, the ultimate goal isn't just to get to truths, but it's to work with what we know in the universe in the context of how it benefits or hurts society.
Yeah, absolutely. Gain of function, what could go wrong? Yeah. I mean, this is, in a way, more of a technology. This particular example is more of a technology issue. Should we make X, Y, or Z? Should we make nuclear weapons? Should we make gain of function viruses? Yeah, I agree with that. But there are also values involved in doing science. I just read a little paper called The Faith of Science, which I laid out what in a way is obvious, although I couldn't find anyone who'd stated it quite that way, that in order to do something, including science, you have to have some values. And in order to do science, you have to, for example, believe that nature is orderly, that there's value in finding out what that order is. You have to believe, in other words, in a single truth. A lot of my humanist colleagues, of course, don't believe in that. They believe in something called standpoint epistemology. So you have your truth, I have mine. That's absolutely antithetical to science, as well as, of course, a bad recipe for harmony in the academy. Everybody has their
truth. But that's also something that's an unscientific view, and it's embraced by different philosophies that believe that man is the source of reality, not an immutable outside force, whether we call that God or we call it nature and nature's God, as Jefferson put it. And that therefore, anything that you think is true, it doesn't matter. And to say otherwise is being somehow prejudiced against you. And that runs completely contrary to what we know to be science, which is an objective understanding of that which is true.
Yeah. The thing is, I think, I mean, we know science is a relatively recent invention. And not all cultures are sympathetic to it. I give an example in the book of a Brahmin Indian who was given a microscope by a British colonialist. This is in the 19th century. This is a highly civilized man, a very bright man. And he was horrified by what he saw, and he gave it back. He said he couldn't stand it. So there are cultures that have that feeling. some views of the Islamic religion argue that it does not believe that there is a fixed universe. Rather, the universe is capricious. It depends on the will of Allah and so on. Mm-hmm. And if that's true, then of course, doing science under those conditions is essentially impossible.
Right. And I don't mean this to sound chauvinistic, but in a sense, for whatever reason, Western civilization embraced the idea that there are immutable truths and that there is immutable ethical and moral laws that exist outside of the manipulation of man, that they can't be invented, that in a sense, there are abstract truths which are as true as concrete truths, and that maybe this is why we have advanced as a civilization, whereas other cultures haven't. And again, I don't mean that in a chauvinistic way, because any culture can embrace truths if they choose to, just like any individual can embrace truths, because truths are true. And right, I mean, they apply to everyone equally. You question, apparently, I'm looking at your the information here. You ask, was Darwin wrong or was he just misunderstood?
Well, yeah, I have a long section in the book on dealing with two issues. One is, can you derive morals from evolution? And I just said a little bit about that. I don't think you can. Very dangerous to even try. And the second is, I think popular Darwinists like Richard Dawkins and so on present a too simple view of Darwinism. And if I take a couple of minutes to summarize what I mean. Mm-hmm. Evolution is the interaction of two forces. One is selection, natural selection, that certain phenotypes, bodies, behavior, and so on, certain phenotypes are selected. The other side is variation, where the pool of things that selection acts upon come from. Now, what I might call radical Darwinists like Richard believe that variation is small and random. A variation from one set of parents to their children and so on is small and random. And if that were true, yes, indeed, selection would be the main engine that drives evolution. But there are a couple of problems with that. One is the variation occurs at the gene level, at the genotypic level, and it may be small. It's not, in fact, completely random that there are correlated hitchhiker genes and so on. There are all sorts of little constraints on it. But the bigger point is that although the variation in the genotype may be small, the variation in the phenotype may not be. In other words, you get snakes with two heads. That's not that infrequent. That's a big change from a relatively small change in the genotype. So the question is, how much structure is there in that variation? Some people, a guy called Goldschmidt, for example, thought that it was directional, it is guided by a purpose. But we don't know whether that's true or not. But what we do know is that it's not completely random. There's some wonderful data that I talk about in the book on African lakes. There are a bunch of African lakes that are very, very similar fish species in them, but they're not genotypically similar at all. And yet these lakes have evolved essentially the same types without any interaction between them. The fish jump from one lake to another. Well, people have speculated that maybe if you run the tape of evolution again, you don't get something completely different as people like Stephen Jay Gould once contended, but rather you get some similar things. So there may be directional structures, what I'm saying, even though evolution in this broad sense is true. And that's worth emphasizing for people who think that somehow Darwinian evolution is contrary to religion or whatever.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've never been able to really make sense out of the Darwinian theory, only in that it seems to me that you cannot have one species pop out of a superior species, or as Darwin said, race, pop out of another. And, you know, if you run on that premise that this could happen in nature, and it has never been proven, even today, after who knows how many millions of hours of research and money and evidence trying to look into it, then what they're saying is basically that one group of species, or even within the human species, is superior to another. And that runs contrary to the biblical understanding, which I actually think is, I wouldn't say more scientific, but I would say more true, but it involves a supernatural element that is outside of science. And that is that all men and women are created equal, that there are no superior groups of people. I mean, Darwin was very into race theory. I mean, he believed that the Aboriginals of Australia were closer to the baboon than the human being. He believed Scottish people were inferior to the English, right? There's writing about it.
Including David Hume, I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that this was, you know, and if you look at the logic of evolution, you could say, okay, some people are more evolved, or some groups of people are more evolved than others. But the point is, it's something that to me, by basic observation, is false. Because, I mean, Darwin's partner, Wallace, proved, he had a falling out with Darwin after he brought a Jivaro tribesman to England, and he was as a baby, and he was educated at Cambridge. He got a proper English education, and he was completely equal to any other Englishman. But, you know, so it kind of proved that here was a man who came from what Darwin would consider a less evolved species of human, but it didn't prove to be the case. And we also could all cite examples. I know of several, I'm not going to mention names, of the children and grandchildren of very brilliant people, very evolved people who aren't so brilliant. I'm just saying that, you know, it's just a simple observation proves that this theory is all wet.
Yeah, the problem that faces us now, though, is that groups are not equal in socially valuable qualities. I mean, there's a huge fuss about the racial disparities, for example.
Right.
And that's not to say the people in the groups aren't all children of God and equally valuable in a moral sense, in a civil sense, and so on. But the fact is, for example, I give an obvious example. To take higher mathematics, for example. If you look at the ability distributions of men and women, there are more men at the high end of the mathematical spectrum than women. And that should not be a controversial thing. And it of course, explains the fact that theoretical physicists tend to be male, nurses and caregivers tend to be female, and so on. And yet it caused the downfall of Larry Summers when he was president of Harvard.
I remember that, yeah.
And that, of course, is absolutely ridiculous. So I think we have to recognize the equal moral standing of every human being, and at the same time, the individual differences that are, in many ways, the strength of the species. I mean, Aborigines are much better adapted to succeed in the Kalahari Desert than you or I would be. And each species is each subspecies or variety, whatever you call it, has adapted to its particular selection environment. That's no reason to disparage anybody, but it's also no reason to deny the reality of human differences.
Well, what you're talking about is the difference between adaptation and evolution, which is something that often evolutionists will confuse and use adaptation in place of. You know, obviously, if a person has darker skin, it's because they've been living for umpteen thousands of years in climates which have sun more intense, closer to the equator, so they need to shield themselves from the rays of the sun. Whereas if somebody is living in Scandinavia, they have lighter skin because you only have sun so many days out of the year, so they need to absorb the maximum amount of sun. Those are adaptations. That's not an evolution. That doesn't make one group superior, which is what evolution is. Evolved. It says you've gotten superior to the point where out comes a new species. That's not the case. It's simply adaptation to different environments and different sets of circumstances. And I also think that you point out accurately that men and women are different. We're equal under the eyes of God, and intellectually and mentally equal, but there are different ways of seeing things that lead to different sets of skills. Like women apparently make fantastic pilots. because there's a certain ability to envision and see, and you know, and you know, it's just that there are different sets of skills. You know, certain people, groups of people are better athletes because of adaptation to mountainous terrain and other environmental factors have led to having stronger bodies and stronger legs than maybe other people, you know, who don't have those kinds of challenges. So these are not a matter of evolution, which is that one is superior or more evolved.
Well, let me stop you there, because superior implies a moral judgment. I mean, the fact that a small fraction of men are better at higher mathematics than women doesn't make them in any sense superior. They're just better mathematicians. The other thing is that adaptation can happen during the life of the individual or between generations. Small evolutionary changes are easy to demonstrate. Most obvious example is the different varieties of dogs. They were all produced by selection, okay? There was an interesting paper about the size of beaks of birds in the Galapagos. Mm-hmm. And during dry years, the birds with bigger beaks did better, and there were more of them. And so more birds with bigger beaks were born. That's natural selection. It does work. The big argument has been whether you get big changes, reptiles mm-hmm. to mammals and so on. That more contentious, much harder to decide. But as I say, if we were to understand more about how variation works, where this variation comes from, how is it directional or not, and so on, I think the solution of that problem will probably come from there.
Okay, John Staden is my guest. The book is Science in an Age of Unreason, published by Regnery. John, you write about ethnic studies, Africana studies, women's studies, all these studies that came up. And, my sense is that these disciplines are sort of, I don't know, I guess you could say Darwinian, in that they really do believe that men and women and blacks and whites and ethnic versus non, that they are literally biologically different, which I don't accept.
Do you think they believe that? I thought they believed men and women were identical.
Okay, maybe. I mean, I get the sense that they think that men and women have a completely different consciousness.
They're a little schizophrenic about it, I think.
Okay.
But I will say one thing that about the idea of systemic racism, mm-hmm. which I encountered years ago and wrote something about, because it seemed to me completely unmeasurable and therefore probably a fallacious idea. Well, just today, by coincidence, I was watching a talk by a professor of Africana studies, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. at Brown University, and she started with the definition of systemic racism, structural racism. And I thought, this is really interesting. I can at last find out what this is. And I have it up here. I wanted to read it to you so you can judge what sense it makes. So okay. Here's the definition: structural racism. Structural racism in the US is the normalization and legitimization of an array of dynamics. Got that? Array of dynamics?
Array of dynamics.
Yeah, right. Historical, cultural, institutional, and interpersonal that routinely advantage whites while producing cumulative and chronic adverse outcomes for people of color. Now, are you clear on that? You got that? I mean, it's absolute nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, it's word salad. And, you know, when you strip it down, they are saying that I think black and white people are de facto different. And then it goes into the Marxist conspiracy theory of exploitation, which, look, exploitation can happen. It certainly obviously happened in slave times. You know, you had a weaker population that was completely exploited by a stronger population. I mean, that's part of the you know, we can learn from that. When people are deprived of freedom, you know, people, the people who are doing the depriving can become depraved and become corrupted and that's evil. You have an evil institution. I mean, that's a lesson that we can learn today. But it doesn't therefore mean that in this day and age, we have to define those things in such stark terms, to the point where our children are being taught that young black children are being oppressed by white children, and that young white children are enjoying some kind of privilege, and therefore that, what, you know, both sides are bad basically, and that, you know, things like math and science are white oppressive things.
Yeah.
So black children are told not to learn those. I mean, because it's being acting white.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just criminal in a way.
The problem is that slavery, which was a horrible thing, is constantly raised as somehow the cause of all of this. The problem is, my impression is, and I haven't studied this super carefully, but my impression is that the disparities between whites and blacks were diminishing until 1964 and the Civil Rights Movement.
Indeed.
And all of these special things that were done. So I think a case can be made. I like to see someone do it properly. That all the privileges, or not privileges, the steps that were taken to somehow help blacks have actually hindered them, because all of these measures have gotten worse. A lot of these measures, like two-parent families and so on, have gotten worse since 1964, where as the distance from slavery has increased, they have gotten worse. That doesn't make sense. It does not make a lick of sense to blame those things on slavery at this distant time. I remember, I think Jason Riley, a black guy who writes for the New York, for the Wall Street Journal, has a book which is called something like "Please Stop Helping Us." And I think he's right. I mean, at least there's pretty good evidence that he's right, that all of these social justice maneuvers that have been made have actually made the discrepancies, the disparities, worse than they would otherwise have been.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it was none other than Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a sociologist, by the way, and who was Assistant Secretary of Labor in the Lyndon Johnson administration, who wrote a book about this, who did a study about this, where he noted that about 80% of black families were intact with marriages, and that literacy was at a very high level, and that he predicted that the implementation of national welfare state policies would erode that and would destroy or damage the black family. And he was almost prophetic in that prediction. Now, I guess, I mean, it gets to a political question, which is that the people that have implemented these programs are not stupid people. They know what they're doing. I mean, is this, and they continue to do it. Is there some kind of an agenda there? I mean, why would they do programs that actually would damage the black family and really damage and divide the country?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'll say one thing before I get to that. The problem with the systemic racism idea is not just that it's meaningless, it's that it deflects attention, as Moynihan probably would have agreed, it deflects attention from the real causes of these discrepancies. The other, so that's a really, really bad thing about that idea. The apropos your point, why do these folks do it? I think it's a combination of what Theodore Dalrymple calls sentimentality, pictures on the television of starving children and so on, sentimentality, plus the fact that politicians do what gets them votes. And by essentially bribing large constituencies, they get the vote of those constituencies. In other words, they're not concerned about the ultimate effect of what they do. They're concerned only with the immediate effect. And
they're buying a constituency to support their power.
Yeah. I mean, in the 18th century, nobody quite knows the author of this, but somebody pointed out that a pure democracy, you know, winner takes all democracy, will never last, because as the poor people are always in the majority, they will eventually act so as to take the money from the richer part, which is a highly unstable arrangement. There are checks and balances in the Constitution to prevent this. And in fact, that was one of their main points. You know, we have two senators in Wyoming and so on. I mean, there are all sorts of things in the Constitution.
Right. Balance of power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which are checks to the tyranny of the majority, which is just as bad as the tyranny of an individual, in some ways much worse, because you can get rid of an individual, you can't get rid of the majority.
Well, I mean, that's the whole ethos and philosophy of the American system, the balance of power on both government level and privately. I mean, it reflects the better aspects of nature. You know, it wasn't invented by our American founding fathers. It actually came from the Anglo-Saxons and their fight to develop the Magna Carta and the different areas of governance. There's the clergy, there was the sheriff, there was the crown, there was, you know, different areas of work, and that they would compete with and balance each other out. You know, it's a system that diffuses power because it recognizes that absolute power in the hands of one group, as Lord Acton said, corrupts absolutely. I mean, it's that's the American system. Now, you write about social science. I'm a student of sociology, and I've noticed that sociology is overwhelmingly on the left. It makes me think that maybe sociology was created as a tool of the left to basically, right? I mean, to do studies and to do research that would promote collectivism and, you know, international leftism. And I have tried to get into developing a conservative sociology, but that involves looking at very controversial things, because the sociology is supposed to look at group behavior and group, you know, activity and, you know, in the context of other groups. And that can get into some rather dicey areas.
Yeah, I mean, the overload of emotion and all of this really impedes science. I mean, I noticed that young people, at least a handful of them that I still keep contact with, are very, very emotionally sensitive. And one young person I talked to about systemic racism was in effect triggered by this. I mean, she didn't want to talk about it anymore. It was just out of
overwhelming,
out of bounds. So that emotional freight is completely antithetical to science. You can't do science without separating the emotional effect of a fact or a piece of data from the fact itself. I mean, Darwin himself wrote that the wonderful quote that a scientist has to have a heart of stone, no wishes, no desires, when he's a scientist, not when he's a human being, but when he's a scientist. Another problem I saw with sociology, I read about in the book, it's subdivided in a crazy way, which early scientists saw was the dangerous way to go. And the British Association, which was a British Science Association in 1900 or so, they had two or three or five divisions, I don't know how many, this is for all of science. Mm-hmm. And somebody suggested adding some new divisions. There was a lot of objection to it because of the weakening of criticism, among other things. I mean, the smaller the cadre of people in a division, the more limited the criticism will be. And what's happened in sociology and psychology, social psychology especially, is a huge increase in the divisions and the number of journals. So you've got totally, in psychology and sociology, over 100 divisions, okay, over 100 divisions. Mm-hmm. Just for social science. And each of those has dozens of journals. So what you get is a sort of theatrical version of science. I write a paper, it's reviewed by reviewers, it's a peer review and so on, it gets published. But the reviewers are a self-selected group of people who agree on the bias, on one set of biases. So you have the appearance of science with peer review and all that, but the result is basically nonsense. And this has been proved several times. And the most famous example is the Sokal hoax, where this physicist, a local guy, I think, actually, wrote a book called Transgressing the Boundaries, Hermeneutics of something or another, quantum gravity or something. Mm-hmm. It had the science in it was all accurate, but the argument was complete nonsense. And yet this was published without review. They thought it was such a great paper. In a journal called Social Text. And more recently, a bunch of people have come out with grievance studies, a book about it and so on, where they publish many, many such things like this. In other words, something which a truly independent selection of reviewers would have immediately spotted as nonsense is publishable as long as you take the right political action, use the right jargon, and so on, you can get it published. So it's a total corruption of a large chunks of sociology. And I have to say, I have good friends in the Duke's sociology department, now retired, of course, and they were cheering me on when I wrote about this. I mean, they deplore all this as much as I do, and I'm not a sociologist. So it's this infinite subdivision has allowed the appearance of science to take over from actual science.
And I think that more objective, more conservative thinkers in science, and again, people may be shocked that this is happening in science. We know what's happened in the soft sciences and in politics. They have been gradually weeded out of academia over many, many decades, and they've been replaced by mediocre thinkers who are politically correct and who kind of parrot a party line. One example of this, and I know I'm bringing up another hot potato here, but is the issue of global warming. Now, I don't doubt that there isn't climate change. I've talked to people off the record about this who tell me that there is climate change, but it's happening extremely slowly, like as in centuries. And it's not this thing like Al Gore with the, henny penny, the sky is falling, And they're scaring the hell out of our young people with that stuff, who are expecting that the world is about to implode over this. And they're basing it on, computer imagings and projections that are not necessarily observable. Why is that? Why are they pushing this particular agenda? Why not have an objective, simple, cross the board look at this important issue?
Well, that's a very good question. I think what one of the things I suggest in the book, and I see there's some evidence for this, is that the science funding system really favors conformity. Mm. That's number one. Number two, for reasons to do with economics, the growth of money pouring into universities and so on, proportion of faculty who are actually tenured or tenured track has been dropping and dropping and dropping. I noticed in my own department, they have a weekly newsletter and they highlight various people and so on. And almost all of them are untenured and not on the tenure track. They're adjunct people. Now, people in that position are very, very vulnerable, right? That's one factor. Another factor is that the funding for science has become what the economists call a monopsony, that is a monopoly buyer. When I was doing experimental research, I in the latter years had only one place I could get major funding from, and that was the National Institute of Mental Health. And one panel on that, a half a dozen or 12 people, decided whether I could get money or not. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, the grant business, grant used to be a bonus. My first grant proposal was 10 double spaced pages. I got the money, it was a bonus. Great. Other people didn't have grants. I mean, it was unusual to get a grant. So by the time I finished, it was a 50 page single page space thing, which took half people's time to prepare. People were spending half their time doing grant proposals. The chance of getting one was very, very small. So all it took is for honest dissent on the committee. Now, if you were a little bit deviant, didn't take any malice on the part of the reviewers. They sincerely believed this was not the best proposal. And anyway, a little deviation could get you kicked off the ladder. So that system encourages actually terrific conformity, insecure position. The university funds for research dropped and dropped and dropped. When I first arrived at a university, the university supported your research, not generously, but you had some research, had some support. By the time I left, it had to be a grant. And in fact, even people I respect, I have a good friend in the physics department. And when I told him about a colleague in biology who managed to do research without getting external funds, sufficiently inexpensive and so on, that he could do it without that, he was appalled. He thought it was irresponsible of this guy not to go out and get a big grant. And that is the ethos. The university has become an entrepreneurial enterprise, and serious deviation or a proposal which just says, I really don't know why I want to do this, but it looks like an interesting thing. No way you're going to get money for that. But that's how creative science, real science, works. People try things, they fail, they fail, they fail. But once in a while, by trying all sorts of things, they find something that works. And the present system is deeply, deeply hostile to that.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, we can't even talk about the question of modalities that are in place around the world that are used to treat viruses like the COVID-19 virus, because if I do talk about it, I could be kicked off of YouTube. you know, right? I mean, that tells you everything you need to know. But the point is that...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We're talking about, as you say, it's a business. It's entrepreneurial, and it has a political agenda that wants certain things to be perceived in a certain way. And that has to do with the modalities of treating the virus, and that those who disagree with that modality, including some people who have previously been amongst America's most respected epidemiologists and doctors, they are censored now. They're not allowed to speak. I don't want to go there because, again, I'll get kicked off YouTube. I think I've said enough. Right now, the whole country is roiling over the end of Roe versus Wade at the Supreme Court. Now, the fact is that the demagoguery around that is really very ugly, given the fact that, first of all, abortion has not been banned, and it's not likely to be banned, except maybe in a handful of states, and that you have some radicals who want to completely ban it. And you also have some radicals, like in my own state of Massachusetts, who want to expand it to include a period of time after the baby's already been born. So you've got extremists on both sides. But the fact is that the science tells us and moves us in the direction of the fact that the unborn child does experience life and that does feel things. And, you know, they've tried to suppress this and they try to hide the ultrasounds and all of that. What is that about? I mean, most countries in the world, including your country and including Germany and France and I think virtually every other country, they regulate abortion after 12 weeks. I mean, and you don't get one after 12 weeks unless the life of the mother is at risk. So this was the only country in the world that had flat, legal, all, you know, abortion on demand right up to the point of birth. Why is this so? What is that agenda all about? I mean, it makes me think of eugenics and it makes me think of Darwin.
Well, Darwin, I have to defend because I think he was an enormously decent man in his private life and so on. And his relations with Wallace, who basically scooped him after Darwin had been working for 20 years on the project and was hesitant to publish until he had overwhelming evidence and so on. So I don't blame Darwin.
Okay.
It's an ideology. I honestly do not understand it. I mean, my book's about science, not faith. And I think this is a strange kind of faith. It's maybe because our communication system, the internet and so on, is too quick and too effective at demonizing. It allows someone to be demonized. And that's happened over and over and over again. People studying individual differences, like Charles Murray, an enormously decent guy, are demonized, and to the point that nobody will listen to them. And if you've got enough disgruntled employees at Google or Facebook, they will be deleted. They will be deleted. It's a terrible phenomenon. I wish I understood it. I mean, it's a social science phenomenon, an area in which I'm far from expert. I'm not sure anybody is really, but it's a religious phenomenon. It's like witch burning, for goodness sake.
Right.
I mean, human nature has not changed since the Middle Ages, but our means of communication have. And maybe that's just amplified all these bad tendencies in human nature. Combine that with a bad educational system, which is, it turns out, has been indoctrinating kids in a kind of woke ideology for generations. Mm-hmm. And you've got a vulnerable population which is susceptible to these kinds of things. I mean, logic, you know, as you say, the Oregon school system says that finding the right answer is racist. I mean, why isn't why isn't there outrage at that? Why isn't the person who wrote that fired from his job as irresponsible? I mean, I don't know. I really don't know, Charles.
Right, right. And I should mention as a program note that I've built up and am building a network that is not censored, and that the cornerstone of that network on my own website, which runs the show live, charlesmoskowitz.com, is Rumble. And the reason that Rumble is not censored is because I pay for Rumble. And because the people at Rumble actually called me and said, promised me that I would not be censored on Rumble. Because look, I've been a radio talk show host off and on in Greater Boston for years. I know what censorship is, and I know what community standards are, and I stick by community standards. I don't do, you know, irresponsible things. I know what I'm doing. And so what I'm dealing with right now is political censorship, which brings me to one more topic before we wrap it up. You have a movement in the United States right now, and I could get in trouble for this on YouTube, pretty much amongst liberals, amongst more upper class people, amongst elites, where young people can decide whether they're a boy or a girl. And right, and that this is, you know, we're not talking here about hermaphroditism or anything biological. We're talking about a social phenomenon. And it is starting to include science in that you have the phenomena, and I don't know how to say this delicately, where we're having young women, young girls under adolescent getting double mastectomies, and young boys getting castration, you know. And I'm not just talking, you know, medical either. I'm talking the surgical. And they're literally believing that they're going to be happy if they change their sex, or that maybe they could switch back and forth and they don't have a sex, or they can be one thing or the other thing, depending upon their mood. And this is, not only is it unscientific, but it's crazy. It's not dealing with basic, it's dangerous for children to be told that they are any of these things. And then they're giving them these drugs that apparently have been banned in Finland and Sweden because they damaged your skeleton. I mean, this is criminal. I mean, it reminds me of Mengele. Yeah, you know, this is like what the Nazis did to twins. I mean, except at least the Nazis knew what they were doing was evil. They weren't pretending that they were doing it to help these children. They didn't care. Whereas in this case, where they're being children being told, oh, this is going to be good for you. This is going to make you feel like your true self. It's going to make you happy. What do you make of this?
Well, I have some personal acquaintance with this. I've got relatives who are involved with this.
I understand. So do I, by the way.
It's everywhere. It's mad. I mean, the first thing is the euphemisms. Mm-hmm. So this castration and mastectomy and so on is called gender affirming therapy, right?
And this is being done by responsible pediatricians and hospitals. Oh, yeah.
And apparently gender affirming therapy is cool, but conversion therapy, which is therapy to persuade a boy that he's a boy and a girl that she's a girl, that's regarded as evil.
Well, first of all, what they're doing is conversion therapy. They're converting boys to girls and girls to boys. I mean,
gender affirming care. You've got it wrong. That you have to get the phrase right. I mean, it's a pathology. It's a cultural phenomenon. I was just looking at an article by somebody called Kaplan, which gives the statistics on the increase, the sort of exponential increase in people. Kids who want to change
it's all over it's everywhere now. And by the way, you know, if an adult wants to do it, if they want to live their life as the opposite sex, that's their business. Look, I'm not that's up to them. I may think that I might look askance personally, but that's their business, and I respect that. But we're not talking about adults here. We're talking about pre-adolescent children.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it is absolutely unbelievable. Right? Yeah, and again, I think it's a cult which has taken over. I don't understand why. There's an attack on white males just because they're white and male. I mean, it's all so grotesque. You can't even parody it because it's a parody of itself, you know.
Indeed, and I mean, my one theory on it, and it's a simplistic theory, and it's not only one piece of it, is that it might be a product of the internet and people's access to information in the same way that QAnon is a product of the internet. you know, the sort of you can change your sex. I mean, these things are phenomena that are very recent and that have to do with the corrupt elements in mass media, which is why we need to learn how to look at the internet and what, you know, what to do, not censor, but just to understand its context. Anyway, John, please let my viewers and listeners know where they can get your excellent book.
Well, thank you for that. Well, Science in an Age of Unreason is available any place, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on. I don't know if your local bookstore has it, but if you ask for it, I'm sure they'll supply it.
They'll have to cough it up. Right. John Staden, I want to thank you for joining me. It's been a pleasure, and I hope to be in touch with you from time to time. Very interesting talk.
You bet. Great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
I don't know if you can hear me still.
I can.
Are you any relation to Howard Moskowitz?
No.
I just got an email from a Howard Moskowitz who was a Harvard graduate a few years after I was. And he wanted to know.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I could look into it, but I don't think so.
Okay. Well, good to talk to you.
Same here. Take care.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.